Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, COVID-19. Midland Memorial Hospital prepares for spike after Thanksgiving, by Caitlin Randall. As health officials nationwide caution families against gathering for Thanksgiving, Midland Memorial is preparing for the inevitable spike in hospitalizations that will follow from those who ignore the warnings. CEO and President Russell Myers said during a press conference Tuesday that everything we do every day is preparing the hospital for a post-holiday spike. There were 101 COVID-19 patients Tuesday out of 238 total patients, Myers said, meaning coronavirus patients make up 42.4% of total hospital occupancy. 47 patients currently are on ventilators. Midland Memorial has been preparing for a continued surge in hospitalizations by opening an additional COVID-19 wing on the ninth floor with 36 more beds. They will add 12 beds to that floor next week, Myers said. Hospital officials have also requested more monitoring devices and ventilators, as well as additional staff from the state and FEMA, according to Myers. We will need more people and continue to ask for more people, he said. Hopefully they'll come in. As the census potentially grows, we'll do as much as we can with the people and space that we have. Additionally, MMH leaders are creating a contingency plan for transferring patients if the hospital becomes full. We have to begin thinking about transferring patients out of our emergency department to other hospitals, Myers said. We think that's a very last resort, but it could happen, and if we do that, they're probably going to be transferred pretty far from here, because our entire region is in the same condition we are. He said they're looking at transferring patients east, such as to Austin, Dallas, or Houston. In a memo last week, the CDC recommended postponing Thanksgiving travel plans and celebrating with family virtually instead, especially for people in an area with a high number of cases or hospitalizations. For those who are gathering for the holidays, the CDC recommended having a small outdoor meal, limiting the number of invited guests, frequently cleaning and disinfecting touched surfaces and items, limiting the number of people in food preparation areas, having guests bring their own food and drinks. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled Consulting Firm Forecasts More Energy Company Mergers, by Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. Mergers will continue to shrink the energy industry as the pandemic rolls into next year, giving fewer companies larger shares of U.S. oil output and threatening to further slash a workforce vital to Texas and Houston. By mid-2021, there will be at least 6 deals among oil and gas companies, including 1 or 2 mergers among oil majors, 2 to 3 large independents taking over smaller players, and 2 or 3 mergers of equal size, small and mid-sized companies, according to a forecast by global consulting firm Accenture. Accenture predicts that half of the country's onshore oil production will be in the hands of 8 to 12 companies by the end of 2021, down from 16 to 17 now. You can't have 5,000 relevant players, said Muksit Ashraf, Accenture's lead energy consultant. There isn't room for so many players. Energy companies have been joining forces since crude prices tumbled from more than $100 a barrel in 2014. The pace of mergers has accelerated after the pandemic strangled demand, sent crude prices to historic lows, and squeezed company profits. U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate settled Tuesday at $44.91. Among notable deals are Chevron's nearly $12 billion acquisition of Houston-based Noble Energy last month, and ConocoPhillips' $9.7 billion takeover of Concho Resources. The oil industry recognizes the benefits of consolidation, Accenture analysts said. Companies need scale to produce oil profitably at low prices, and larger companies can more easily access Wall Street capital and boost their footing in top-producing oil fields to remain relevant, Ashraf said. Consolidation fortifies these companies to withstand the onslaught of low oil prices, Ashraf said. But the mergers, while helping to boost production, leave behind a slew of redundant positions that eventually are eliminated, said Manas Satapathy, Accenture's Managing Director for Energy Mergers and Acquisitions. Companies are thinking about squeezing out a lot of inefficiencies and costs, Satapathy said. They're asking, why do we need so many managers in the Permian? Energy companies already have laid off 17,500 drilling-related workers in the Houston region since 2018, with more than 70% of those cuts made during the nearly year-long pandemic, according to the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers. While it appears the number of job losses stemming from the pandemic is slowing this fall, more mergers will simply add to the area's gloomy jobless situation. Analysts have said they're unsure how long the current wave of consolidations will last, given the difficult economic conditions and Wall Street's unwillingness to extend capital to the struggling energy sector. Investors worried about company spending, mounting debt, and dwindling returns have pulled out of the energy sector, which this year has become the worst performer of the S&P 500 stock index. This article is entitled COVID-19. Council approves $1.4 million in CARES funding by Caitlin Randall. The Midland City Council on Monday approved granting $1.4 million in federal CARES Act funding to Midland Memorial Hospital for projects related to the COVID-19 pandemic. The funding will cover an additional testing site in Southeast Midland, an outpatient infusion center for a recently approved antibody treatment, hospital beds and equipment, and the costs of additional critical care physicians and staff. Some funding will also be used to cover a future vaccination program, according to an agenda packet for Monday's council meeting. The vaccine will be offered free of charge once approved by the FDA and released. Council members said during Monday's meeting the city and hospital will likely be coordinating on more funding over the next few weeks. This article is entitled COVID-19. County, City will work to enforce 50% occupancy by Caitlin Randall. Midland County and the City of Midland released a joint statement Monday night telling businesses to reduce occupancy to 50% and bars to close because of a rule in Governor Greg Abbott's executive order that requires additional restrictions for areas with high coronavirus hospitalizations. County Judge Terry Johnson said during a press conference Tuesday that the county and city will be working together to enforce Abbott's order. In a phone interview, Emergency Management Coordinator Justin Bunch said there are a few possibilities for what that enforcement may look like. For businesses that have been ordered to reduce capacity, the Sheriff's Office and Police Department would likely receive complaints about businesses that have opened beyond what's allowed and file reports, he said. From there, the city or county fire marshal could cite businesses for being over capacity. The Midland Health Department could also inspect businesses and revoke their health certificates if they're in violation of the order, according to Bunch. Bars that receive more than 51% of their revenue from alcohol sales are required to close under Abbott's order. Bunch said enforcement for bars would come from the Texas Alcohol and Beverage Commission, which could repeal the business licenses of bars that remain open. Midland County received a notice from the Texas Department of State Health Services on Monday saying hospitalizations in Trauma Service Area J have been above 15% of total hospital capacity for 7 consecutive days, which triggers the additional restrictions for businesses. When asked why the county would be enforcing the 50% occupancy rule, but not Abbott's executive order regarding masks, Bunch said the wording of the mask mandate made enforcement nearly impossible. If you're not wearing a mask, the police can't stop you or detain you under Abbott's order, he said. They really have no recourse. Bunch said the only option given to local police entities under that order would be to enforce trespassing laws and remove violators of the mask mandate from businesses that request it. If a county refuses to comply with the occupancy rule, Bunch said the state could withhold funding or send state health department officials to investigate violations. Other areas of Texas already have been required to scale back to 50% occupancy because of high COVID-19 hospitalizations. 22 counties in the Lubbock-centered TSA B were ordered to roll back to earlier restrictions on October 26th. Coronavirus hospitalizations in the Midland-Odessa TSA must drop below 15% of total hospital capacity for 7 consecutive days before the restrictions can be lifted, according to Abbott's order. This article is entitled, Crude Prices Up 4.3%, Hit Highest Level Since March, by Andres Guerra-Luz, Bloomberg. Oil reclaimed heights not seen since the pandemic pummeled prices in the spring, with the start of the U.S. presidential transition and improved vaccine prospects infusing optimism across markets. Prices rose 4.3% in New York to the highest since early March. The forward curves for both West Texas Intermediate and Brent have strengthened thanks to rising demand from Asia and progress toward a widespread vaccine rollout. WTI closed at $44.91, up $1.85. The rally accelerated with the start of a formal transition process to U.S. President-elect Joe Biden, sending the Dow Jones Industrial Average past 30,000 for the first time. The fact that we have more certainty and what hopefully is an orderly transition is putting some wind in the sails for crude, said Stuart Glickman, energy equity analyst at CFRA Research. The biggest issue ahead is how willing they'll be able to cross the aisle and enable a stimulus package to happen. That's going to be a primary driver for prices. The start of the transition process for the U.S. presidency offers a welcome sense of certainty following disputes over the outcome of the November 3rd election. Additionally, reports that Biden is planning to tap former Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen for Treasury Secretary is also raising hopes for more economic stimulus that could provide a much-needed demand boost. Elsewhere, a rebound in Chinese domestic flights is aiding demand for jet fuel, the hardest-hit oil product. That broad recovery has helped drive the market's return to the bullish structure known as backwardation, where the nearest contracts rally more than the later-dated ones, in a sign that supply and demand are returning to balance. One of the most significant shifts in the shape of the forward curve is the strengthening of the so-called WTI red spread, with futures for December of next year at a premium relative to December 2022. The move to backwardation often attracts passive flows into the market, leading to further price rallies. But while the market may be strengthening on the outlook for improved demand in the near future, the pandemic's effects are still rippling around the globe. Total SE, said it will halt its Dongas refinery for several months as it's currently unprofitable due to weak demand. Several refineries in the U.S. have shut because of the collapse in fuel demand. While inventories at the National Storage Hub in Cushing, Oklahoma, should ultimately tighten, WTI time spreads face further weakness in the near term amid rising Canadian supplies and risks to refining demand, according to Bank of America Global Research Report. Cushing stockpiles have risen toward levels last seen in May after the WTI plunged below zero. Over the coming months, Canadian supply will likely recover further as oil sands operations are restored. But production in the Bakken, Niobrara, and Oklahoma will likely be nearly flat versus current levels, the report said. This, combined with the potential for weaker refinery demand on lockdowns, could push Cushing inventories higher in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, in the U.S., crude inventories are expected to increase, according to a Bloomberg survey, after 2 weeks in a row of storage builds. The industry-funded American Petroleum Institute will report its figures later Tuesday ahead of a U.S. government tally. This is the local and region page. These are the death notices for Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. Angel Navarrete. Angel Navarrete, 81, of Midland, Texas, passed away Sunday, November 22nd. Viewing will be Friday, November 27th from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a prayer service starting at 7 p.m. Friday evening at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. A funeral service is set for Saturday, November 28th at 2 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. He is survived by his son, Jose Angel Navarrete, four daughters, Blanca Galindo, Annabel Rodriguez, Maria S. Madrid, and Aida Navarrete, two brothers, one sister, numerous grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, and cousins. Arturo V. Hassel. Arturo V. Hassel, 57, of Midland, passed away November 22nd. Viewing will be from 3 p.m. to 9 p.m., with rosary being recited at 7 p.m. Sunday, November 29th at the Branch at Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, November 30th at the Branch, with interment following at Serenity Memorial Garden Cemetery. Survivors include wife Anna and children Ruth Maria Hassel, Aaron Hassel, David Hassel, and Moses Hassel. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Fabian Jaquez Ray, 82, of Midland, passed away on November 19th. A graveside service is set for Wednesday, November 25th at 2 p.m. at Serenity Memorial Gardens. He is survived by his wife, Cruz Carrasco, 12 children, Sylvia Ray, Otilia Ray, Edviges Ray, Irma Avia, Jesus Ray, Nicholas Ray, Tito Ray, Inez Franco, Lucia Morales, Azucena Elizondo, Mario Ray, and Ana Maria Leyva. Five brothers, one sister, 34 grandchildren, 20 great-great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces and nephews. Maudie Robison Campbell. Maudie Robison Campbell, 70, of Midland, died Saturday, November 21st in Midland. Graveside services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, November 27th at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Jennifer Dawson is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Ronald Bud Harrison. Ronald Bud Harrison, 91, of Midland, passed away on Monday, November 23rd. A viewing will be held from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Friday, November 27th at Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home. A Grades 5 service will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, November 28th at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled Anti-COVID Restriction Backlash is Coming by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. The backlash is coming. It already seems clear that the first major political and culture eruption of the Biden years will be a roiling populist backlash against the next round of COVID restrictions. We saw this sentiment play out in sporadic anti-lockdown demonstrations last spring, and it has driven ongoing resistance to masks. But it is, in all likelihood, about to reach an entirely new level, fueled by exhaustion with the virus, elite hypocrisy, and the shattered credibility of the public health establishment. The ascension of Joe Biden will add force to the reaction. It is an iron law of American politics that whichever party doesn't control the presidency will suspect the other of plotting to impose a tyranny. So the fear and loathing of COVID restrictions, somewhat muted on the right while Donald Trump was president, will deepen and intensify. The right's populism and limited government impulse, which has separated in the Trump years, will presumably be reunited in the push against lockdowns in a way that they haven't been since the Tea Party. Lockdowns, mask police, curfews, what about freedom? Asked conservative Representative Jim Jordan in a recent tweet forecasting things to come. It'd be much better if we could find a prudent middle path through the next several months as the pandemic enters its worst phase, and as new vaccines arrive that will soon start changing everything. But a significant segment of the American public has lost its patience with a new normal that has at times been arbitrarily and poorly thought through. When the new virus first hit our shores, and we knew much less about it, the case for lockdowns was strong to keep the healthcare system from getting overwhelmed and to play for time and better treatments. In retrospect, though, the nationwide lockdowns of the spring closed down some states before they experienced their initial waves of the disease, imposing economic, mental health, and medical costs without much upside. After that kind of sacrifice, it's hard to double dip and ask people to do it again, especially when the latest advice runs against the grain of one of the nation's oldest traditions, namely Thanksgiving, and when prominent pro-restriction office holders discredit themselves with their own behavior. A week or so ago, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot told residents of her city, "You must cancel the normal Thanksgiving plans, particularly if they include guests that do not live in your immediate household." Yet just days earlier, she happily joined a crowd celebrating Joe Biden's election victory. Afterwards, she said that there are times when, quote, "we actually do need to have relief and come together," unquote, without explaining why this wide-ranging justification wouldn't apply to the Thanksgiving gatherings she wanted to cancel. During this moment, the political class should have been especially sensitive to playing by its own rules, when those rules have been so relatively easy to bear for the elite and so punishing for ordinary workers. Still, the likes of Nancy Pelosi and Gavin Newsom have flouted COVID strictures rather than forego a visit to a hair salon or a world-class French restaurant. The appeal of such politicians and the incoming Biden administration is always to public health experts, even though they too have largely jettisoned any claim to public trust. To simplify and generalize, at the beginning of this year, they downplayed the virus for fear that it would stroke xenophobia. Then they launched into five-alarm fire mode. They poured cold water on masks before turning around and insisting on them, despite ambiguous evidence on the efficacy of cloth masks. They preached the gospel of social distancing until mass Black Lives Matter protests erupted, blessing these huge, often unruly gatherings because fighting racism is supposedly a paramount public health issue. The upshot will be poisonous contention in the months ahead before the advent of that most American solution, the clever technological fix in the form of transformative vaccines. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, "Reported Israeli-Saudi Meeting is a Big Deal," by Henry Olson, Washington Post. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman reportedly met in secret with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Sunday evening. This has been denied officially by Saudi sources, but it would be consistent with the recent trend of rapprochement between the historic enemies. This development, a de facto anti-Iranian alliance between Israel and the Gulf Arab kingdoms, probably will dramatically alter what the incoming Biden administration's Middle East policy will look like. The enmity between the Jewish state and the Arab Islamic world is long and deep. Israel fought four wars with its neighbors between 1948 and 1973, and has engaged in continuing conflict with many Arab states ever since. Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf nations had participated in some of those wars, bankrolled Palestinian terrorist groups, and refused to diplomatically recognize Israel. Even as Israel made peace with Egypt and Jordan, Saudi Arabia and its allies continued to consider peace with any Israeli government as unacceptable. That has changed for the oldest of diplomatic reasons, self-interest. The Iranian regime views both Israel and the Sunni Gulf kingdoms as illegitimate and has worked tirelessly to bring them down. Tehran also funds terrorist groups such as Hezbollah and rebel groups such as those in Yemen to put military pressure on Saudi Arabia and Israel. This alone brings these two together. Iran's attempt to bring Iraq fully under its sway particularly presents threats to the Saudis and the Gulf kingdoms. Iraq shares extensive borders with Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. If Iranian-backed troops were ever stationed in the Shiite regions in southern Iraq, they could easily launch an invasion at a moment's notice. Saudi Arabia's eastern province, which is directly south of Kuwait, holds much of the kingdom's oil wealth and Shiite population, and the oil-rich Gulf kingdoms also all border the eastern province. It is crucial to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf kingdom's security that Iranian forces be kept as far away as possible. It is against this backdrop that Iran's pursuit of a nuclear weapon must be understood. Were Iran ever to obtain such a weapon, its ballistic missile technology would put Israel and the Arabs alike at risk of nuclear blackmail. That, in turn, amplifies the conventional military power of Iran and its proxies. The Islamic Republic could launch invasions or incursions as it pleases, secure in the knowledge that its nuclear weapons would deter serious retaliation. Changes in U.S. policy during the Obama administration sent shockwaves into the region. Israel, which is believed to possess its own nuclear deterrent, and the Arab kingdoms had long relied on the United States to protect them against Iranian subversion. The Iran nuclear agreement clearly called that implicit guarantee into question. For the Israelis, it meant they could no longer be sure that U.S. troops would be deployed to assist them in a crisis. For the Gulf kingdoms, it meant they needed a firm, nuclear-armed ally whose commitment to opposing Iraq was unquestioned. The recent dramatic changes in Arab policy toward Israel make sense when viewed in this light. For Israel, an alliance with the Arab Gulf powers provides military might that could be deployed on its behalf in the event of a mutual threat. It also provides, in theory, geographic proximity to Iran to launch any secret incursions that U.S. ships or bases might currently provide. For the Arabs, it ensures that a nuclear-armed power stands behind them, should Iran ever obtain a weapon, and establishes a connection with Israel's vaunted intelligence agencies. A de facto alliance would also reduce dependence on the United States and its domestic political whims, replacing U.S. mediation with direct ties between the nation's security apparatuses. Abandoning the Palestinians in the face of such concrete advantages is, if artfully done, obviously in the security interests of the Saudis and Gulf kingdoms. President-elect Joe Biden's national security appointments, reported Monday, are not likely to give either side more comfort. John Kerry, who will serve as Biden's climate envoy, was Secretary of State when the Iranian nuclear accord was signed and was part of the Obama administration's not-so-subtle opposition to Netanyahu in the 2015 Israeli election. The incoming Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, signed a letter calling on the Democratic Party to revise its draft 2020 platform language on Israel to make it more vocally opposed to Netanyahu's stated goals regarding the West Bank and Palestinian statehood. Israel and the Arab kingdoms know that Iran means to destroy them. As writer Samuel Johnson once put it, impending death concentrates the mind wonderfully. The Biden administration is likely to find that this alliance of strange bedfellows will force its Middle East policy to look much more like the Trump administration's than any of them currently imagine. This column is entitled, Vaccine Distribution Shouldn't Be Fair, by Tyler Cowen, Bloomberg. As an increasing body of evidence suggests America's new anti-COVID vaccines are both efficacious and safe, the question of how to distribute those vaccines assumes greater importance. One poll suggests that Americans think healthcare workers, the elderly, and people with compromised immune systems should receive vaccines very early. But what to do after that? There is an uncomfortable truth here. Most of the best distribution methods are blatantly unfair. In this context, however, fairness is overrated. Priority should be given to methods that will save more lives and bring back the economy more rapidly. A central yet neglected point is that vaccines should not be sent to each and every part of the U.S. Instead, it would be better to concentrate distribution in a small number of places where the vaccines can have a greater impact. Say, for the purposes of argument, that you had about 20,000 vaccine doses to distribute. There are about 20,000 cities and towns in America. Would you send one dose to each location? That might sound fair, but such a distribution would limit the overall effect. Many of those 20,000 recipients would be safer, but your plan would not meaningfully reduce community transmission in any of those places, nor would it allow any public events to restart or schools to reopen. Alternatively, say you chose one town or well-defined area and distributed all 20,000 doses there. Not only would you protect 20,000 people with the vaccine, but the surrounding area would be much safer too. Children could go to school, for instance, knowing that most of the other people in the building had been vaccinated. Shopping and dining would boom as well. Over time, mobility, migration, and mixing would undo some of the initial benefits of the geographically concentrated dose of vaccines. That's why the second round of vaccine distribution could go exactly to those people who are most likely to mix with the first targeted area. This plan reaps two benefits: protecting the people in the newly chosen second area, and limiting the ability of those people to disrupt the benefits already gained in the first area. In other words, if the first doses went to, choose a random example, to Wilmington, Delaware, the next batch of doses should go to suburbs of Wilmington. In economics language, one can say that COVID-19 infections and protections have externalities, and there are increasing returns to those externalities. That implies a geographically concentrated approach to vaccine distribution, whether at the federal or state level. Of course, that is not how U.S. politics usually works. On the national level, there is a tendency in such things as infrastructure or defense bills to give something to each state. At the state level, it is hard to imagine New Jersey, for instance, concentrating on Hudson and Essex counties for its vaccines and neglecting the shore. Party politics, if nothing else, mitigate against it. Yet distributing the vaccines in geographically concentrated fashion would create some natural experiments and generate information of national value. If, for instance, almost everyone in an area is vaccinated, the nation will have a better sense of how demand for flu shots, dental visits, homeschooling, and many other services will change in post-COVID America. If it turns out that there are unexpected side effects to the vaccine, they will become more obvious more quickly, as the local doctors would be inundated with a particular kind of complaint. At the same time, there will be practical limits on a fully concentrated geographic distribution of vaccines. Too many vaccines sent to too few places will result in long waits and trouble with storage. Nonetheless, at the margin, the U.S. should still consider a more geographically concentrated distribution than what it is likely to do. Speaking of unfairness, who else should get vaccine doses very early on? NBA players, for one? Their vaccinations could be televised, and their nightly displays of scoring and rebounding would show the American people that vaccines are quite safe. And how about early doses for leaders of the anti-mask movements? If they will take them, that is. Aren't they relatively likely to be super spreaders? The fairest solution to vaccine distribution, of course, would be to run a lottery. I humbly suggest a lottery in which you have to live in Fairfax County, Virginia, my home. If you're thinking, hey, that's not fair, well, that is exactly the point. This article is entitled Oil Price Increases, OPEC Plus Delays Recommendation on Output, by Andres Guerra-Loz, Bloomberg. Oil closed higher as a weaker dollar offset OPEC Plus committee's decision to hold off on offering a recommendation on whether a planned production hike should move forward. Futures rose 0.2% in New York in an afternoon rally after falling as much as 1.9% earlier in Tuesday's session. The Bloomberg Dollar Spot Index fell as much as 0.3%, boosting the appeal for commodities priced in the currency. Meanwhile, West Texas Intermediate December options expired Tuesday, with $42 call options the most active. WTI closed at $41.43, up 9 cents. Prices weakened earlier after an OPEC Plus committee meeting ended without a concrete signal that producers will reverse plans to increase outcome come January. The producer group had been discussing postponing an output increase by 3 to 6 months. Yet Saudi Arabia Minister Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman said the market is too fluid to make a decision on the cuts now. The combination of option expiration in WTI and short covering in Brent were key drivers behind today's late-day oil rally, said Ryan Fitzmaurice, commodity strategist at Rabobank.
Last week's vaccine news and subsequent oil rally forced CTAs to begin covering this outsized position as the spot contract rallied above many key moving averages. West Texas Intermediate crude futures are trading above the 50-day, 100-day, and 200-day moving averages. The OPEC alliance is wrestling with a bifurcated demand outlook. In Asia, where consumption has recovered substantially from COVID-19, refiners have been snapping up barrels from the Middle East, US, and Russia. The structure of Oman futures on the Dubai Mercantile Exchange has surged into a bullish backwardation, indicating tight supplies in recent days. Yet in Europe and the US, a surge in coronavirus cases has led to tougher restrictions, limiting movement and consumption. There's still a question of how much demand growth there'll be, said Rob Hayworth, senior investment strategist at US Bank Wealth Management. This is a meaningful near-term problem, given still abundant supply and no real evidence of an uptick in global demand growth yet. This article is entitled Analysts. Oil companies on track to discover 10 billion barrels this year, by Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. Oil companies are on track to discover 10 billion barrels this year, despite the coronavirus pandemic temporarily halting exploration activity this spring. More than 8 billion barrels of crude and associated natural gas have been discovered so far this year, up from a decades low 7.7 billion discovered in 2019 during the last oil bust, according to Rystad Energy. Global oil and gas operators will chase plenty of additional volumes in wildcats planned for the final 2 months of the 2020, although some may not be completed until early 2021 and will therefore add to next year's tally, Palzor Shenga, a senior upstream analyst with Rystad, said in a statement. Oil exploration activity has remained resilient this year, despite concerns that the global pandemic would drive down crude discoveries to its lowest level in decades. Oil and gas companies have been drilling in mature oil fields, such as Brazil and Norway, as well as in promising new prospects called wildcats in Suriname, Guyana, South Africa, and Turkey. Most of the discovered oil took place in Russia, with 1.5 billion barrels, followed by Suriname with 1.4 billion barrels, and the United Arab Emirates with 1.1 billion barrels, the Norwegian energy research firm said. Companies that made the most discoveries so far this year include Russia's Gazprom, French major Total, Houston-based Apache. The Houston Independent has found about 700 million barrels of oil and gas this year, mainly off the coast of Suriname, according to Rystad. Despite the prolific discoveries, less than half of the oil and gas discovered this year will be extracted by 2040. That's because oil and gas companies are scrutinizing projects more closely than before as the pandemic has squeezed their bottom lines. Only the prospects with the highest chance for success will likely be drilled, Rystad said. This article is entitled OPEC Plus Voices Caution on Oil Market as it Mulls Output Hike Delay, by Grant Smith, Salma L. Wardanay, Javier Blas, and Dina Krenikova, Bloomberg. As OPEC Plus began talks on whether to postpone January's oil production increase, ministers sounded cautious about the strength of global demand. Saudi Energy Minister Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman said he could see a light at the end of the tunnel thanks to the development of COVID-19 vaccines. But the market had some ways to go before getting there. His counterparts from Algeria and Russia talked about bumps in the road and an uncertain winter, adding to the impression that the group is open to considering a delay. There has been very good news of possible vaccines against the COVID-19 virus, allowing us to see some glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel, Prince Abdulaziz said at the opening session of an OPEC Plus video conference on Tuesday. But the good news was counterbalanced by a surge in cases in the second wave of infections. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies are considering whether to postpone a 2 million barrel a day production increase scheduled for January by between 3 and 6 months. The online talks of the Joint Ministerial Monitoring Committee could make a recommendation, but the final decision won't come until a full OPEC Plus meeting on November 30th to December 1st. In addition to the medical breakthroughs, signs of a strong demand recovery in Asia are giving cause for optimism, said Prince Abdulaziz. Yet he also emphasized the negative impact of another round of lockdowns in Europe and the supply increase from Libya. The world has a better understanding of how to fight the pandemic. New restrictions have a milder effect on demand, and we see a very significant progress in development of vaccines, said Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak. We need to continue showing commitment to our obligations, taking into account today's uncertainties and the market situation amid winter demand. While crude prices rallied to $45 a barrel in London last week following news of a breakthrough on a COVID-19 vaccine, they remain far lower than most OPEC nations need to cover government spending. There is also a risk that oil demand will remain depressed for many months during the slow rollout of vaccines. There is still a way to go before we reach the other end of the long-awaited pandemic tunnel, Prince Abdulaziz said. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled Black Lives Matter Had Political Effect Many Expected by Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. Black Lives Matter came up with the single most effective political slogan of the year. While no one was likely to be overly impressed with Joe Biden's line, Build Back Better, and Donald Trump's Keep America Great, or Make America Great Again, didn't have the resonance of the original 2016 version. Black Lives Matter broke through the clutter with a catchphrase that was memorable, pungent, and utterly devastating to Democrats. After a surprising Tory victory in the British parliamentary election in 1992, the pro-Tory tabloid The Sun famously boasted, "It's the Sun what won it." In the same spirit, it could be said that in this year's congressional election, it's defund the police what lost it. Democrats have an uphill battle to take the U.S. Senate, pretending two Georgia runoffs, and suffering shocking setbacks in the House that drastically diminished their majority. All over the map, Democrats got hammered on defunding the police, which couldn't have been better designed to extract maximum political pain with zero upside. Black Lives Matter has been a stunning success in the elite culture. It won the obeisance of almost every major institution, from corporate America to sports leagues to colleges. It created a powerful, if dishonest, narrative of systemic police racism. It got invested with nearly a holy significance, such that criticizing it is considered at least a sin and perhaps a firing offense. Much more importantly, at least for a time after the death of George Floyd in police custody in Minneapolis, it won the goodwill of a clear majority of Americans. To take this position of strength and use it primarily to associate your allies with a politically radioactive position requires extraordinary strategic folly and heedless ideological fanaticism. BLM had both in ample supply. The notion of defunding the police had been rattling around the left for a long time, but the George Floyd protests took it mainstream. BLM leaders touted the idea and scolded Democrats for not getting on board. "Read the room," one implored. "People are calling for defunding the police." Activists painted slogan on a street leading to the White House.
BLM pushed municipalities to actually act on the proposal. Whenever someone tried to take the edge off defunding the police by redefining it as simply reallocating some law enforcement dollars, defenders piped up to say, "No, we really mean it." Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez balked at a proposal to cut $1 billion in police funding in New York City. Defunding the police means defunding the police. The New York Times ran an op-ed against incrementalist interpretations. "Yes, we mean literally abolish the police." Predictably, Republicans took the weapon handed to them and used it, as Democrats would have done if a voluble faction on the right called for, say, abolishing child welfare agencies. The effectiveness of the attack now has Democrats, who are otherwise loath to speak ill of BLM, complaining about what its catchy slogan did to the party. The consequences have been even worse in riot-plagued Minneapolis. The city council took BLM not only seriously, but literally. It absurdly vowed to defund an already demoralized and overwhelmed police force. The city has been suffering an ongoing crime wave, with shootings of black victims skyrocketing as police struggle to respond. After support for BLM surged last spring, positive feelings for it have been declining. A Pew Research report showed support for BLM dropping from 67% in June to 55% in September. Only 45% of white people expressed support for the movement. Given that BLM elevated the dumbest, most destructive slogan in American politics in a very long time, and an even more atrocious policy, its numbers deserve to fall further. Advocates of defunding the police argued that setting out an extreme position could have a political effect, even if it had no chance of enactment. This column is entitled "Trump's Plan to Win in 2024" by Mark A. Thiessen, Washington Post Writers Group. President Donald Trump has every right to pursue recounts and legal challenges to the 2020 election, but he needs to realize these challenges won't change the final result. This is not 2000, when just 537 votes in a single state determined the result. The president would need to overcome a deficit of tens of thousands of votes in three states to win. That will not happen. So Trump needs a way forward. How he exits the White House could leave an indelible impression on voters' minds. No one likes a sore loser. Here is an 8-point plan for how Trump can leave the presidency with the best chance to reclaim it in 4 years. 1. Cooperate with the Biden transition while pursuing your legal challenges. Trump should authorize Joe Biden to receive the president's daily brief, PDB, and instruct his officials to cooperate with Biden's transition team. The 9/11 Commission blamed the failure to anticipate the 9/11 attacks, in part on the delay in the Bill Clinton to George W. Bush transition. Trump should not expose himself to criticism if we are attacked on Biden's watch. Moreover, one of his greatest legacies will be Operation Warp Speed, which is producing the fastest delivery of a vaccine for a novel virus in history and requires a smooth handover to succeed. If he ends up flipping the election results, such cooperation will not have done any harm. But if he doesn't, his failure to do so could set him up for blame down the road for Americans' deaths. 2. When the Electoral College meets on December 14th and declares Biden the winner, concede and say you are stepping aside for the sake of the country. Trump can continue to hold that the election was stolen and run to reclaim his stolen presidency in 4 years' time. But to win again, Trump needs to understand why he lost. There are millions of voters who approved of his policies but did not vote for him because they were tired of chaos. They gave Trump the margin of victory. If Trump mishandles the transition, his behavior will only validate those voters' choices and make it less likely that they will change their minds in 2024. 3. Announce you are running in 2024. Trump should shift the focus from the last election to the next one, pointing his followers toward the future and rallying them. 4. Lead the GOP to keep control of the Senate. Trump can fire the first salvo of 2024 with victories in the Georgia Senate runoffs in January. He should do so not by focusing on the last election, but by telling his supporters their vote is about the future. If Democrats take control of the Senate, he can say, they will enact socialist policies that he won't be able to reverse in 4 years' time. Just look at how hard it has been to undo Obamacare, and imagine what Democrats will do with unfettered power to pass anything they want on energy, climate, health care, immigration, and taxes. Step one in taking back the White House is keeping control of the Senate. 5. Deliver an unprecedented farewell address. Most departing presidents deliver a nationally televised farewell address from the White House. But it has been more than a century since a president left the White House and then successfully stood for re-election 4 years later. Trump should use his speech to declare, in the words of General Douglas MacArthur, I shall return. 6. Preside over a gracious transfer of power. Invite Biden to the White House, ride with him to the Capitol, and attend the inauguration. Leave the White House with dignity. 7. Guide the party to retake the House in 2022. With Trump at the top of the ticket in 2020, Republicans nearly took the House, winning a net 8 seats so far, with a possibility of 13 when the final votes are tallied. There are at least 26 seats so far that Democrats won with 52% of the vote or less, which means control of the House is in play in 2022. Trump should lead the party to finish the job, defeat House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat California, and take back the House majority. 8. Take back the presidency. If he helps Republicans hold the Senate in 2021 and then take back the House in 2022, Trump will have a head of steam going into 2024 and a good shot at returning as the 47th president. The left is hoping the Biden administration will be the beginning of a new progressive era. In fact, the Biden years could be little more than a brief interregnum, but only if Trump handles the next 6 weeks correctly. This article is entitled, Former Iowa Governor Could Have Top Role in Energy Department, by Jennifer Jacobs and Jennifer A. DeLuey, Bloomberg. President-elect Biden's transition team has spoken to former Iowa Governor Chet Culver about joining the new administration, according to two people familiar with the matter. A possible senior role in the Energy Department that would draw on Culver's expertise in renewable power has been discussed, according to one of the people who asked not to be named during discussing a personnel matter. The conversation comes as the Biden-Harris transition team takes early steps to begin building a new administration, including appointing some 4,000 individuals for roles across the federal government. Attention has focused on who Biden will tap for cabinet posts and key White House positions, though the president-elect's selection of other top officials will also help signal his approach to policy priorities from clean energy to climate change. Culver, a former high school teacher who now runs a renewable energy consulting firm, championed biofuels and wind and solar power during his 4-year tenure as Iowa's governor. If Culver were to be offered and accept a top role in the Energy Department, it would mark a shift at the agency currently led by officials with oil industry ties, in keeping with Biden's promises to support electric vehicles and clean energy. Iowa measures. As Iowa's governor, Culver viewed renewable power as an economic engine for the state. He established its Office of Energy Independence and in 2009 signed into law measures opening tax credits to small wind energy products and other incentives designed to lure renewable component manufacturers to Iowa. Culver was defeated by Republican Terry Branstad in 2010. As co-chair of the National Governors Association's Wind Coalition, Culver also unsuccessfully pressed the Obama-Biden administration to impose a renewable energy standard requiring utilities to draw a percentage of their power from alternative sources. A Biden-Harris transition spokesman declined to comment. Culver didn't respond to a request for comment. Culver has long family ties to the Bidens. His father served alongside Biden in the Senate in the 1970s and endorsed the president-elect 10 days before the Iowa caucuses.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.